The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Clara Park, and I am a chef teacher in Philadelphia and proud member of the Culinary Literacy Advisory Council that supports the work of the Free Library's Culinary Literacy Center. Well, it's quite clear that the large crowd sold out here tonight knows exactly who Sola is. But just in case some of you don't, she is a chef, writer, video producer, and community advocate who also hosts Mystery Menu for New York Times Cooking YouTube channel and the History Channel's Ancient Recipes with Sola, and serves as a judge on HBO Max's The Big Brunch. She's also a new mom. She formerly worked as an assistant food editor at Bon Appetit, where she frequently appeared in the magazine's cooking videos, and she has been featured on Food 52, Serious Eats, and on the popular Babish Culinary Universe YouTube channel. A graduate of the prestigious Culinary Institute of America, El Whaley trained at various New York City restaurants, including Del Posto, Atera, and Battersby, before opening a restaurant in Brooklyn with her husband. In Start Here, the recipe developer serves up a transformative guide to the fundamentals of good cooking alongside a mix-and-match batch of recipe variations. Reem Kassis is a Palestinian writer and author of the award-winning cookbooks The Palestinian Table and The Arabesque Table, and the children's book We Are Palestinian. Woo! Her writing regularly appears in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post. She grew up in Jerusalem, then obtained her undergraduate and MBA degrees from UPenn and Wharton, and her Master's of Science in Social Psychology from the London School of Economics. She now lives in Philadelphia with her husband and three daughters. I know we're all eager to hear what should be a dynamic and informative discussion tonight, so please join me in welcoming Sola and Reem to the stage.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Sola. I know I'm very excited to have this conversation with you. I was just telling her it's the first time I leave my baby since she was born. And Sola just had a baby 3 months ago.
Yeah, I leave her all the time.
You're amazing. Well, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
If you've held it. If any of you guys have held her book, you also know it's very heavy, which is very useful in the kitchen, actually.
Yeah, you can use it to, you know, press schnitzel.
Yes. Strain Lebanese.
Tofu.
Tofu.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Uh-huh. See, it works, you know, for more than one thing. Mm-hmm. So, on a more serious note, when I was reading your intro, there was something in it that really struck me. I'm going to read out the sentence to you guys. I look like someone who would have done well in school. I don't know if it's the glasses, short bob haircut, model minority myth, or some combo of all of the above. But people assume I was the girl in the front row with my hand always up. The truth is different from that, though. And you go on to say, I almost didn't graduate high school due to an excess of absences. I dropped out of college my freshman year. Don't worry, aunties, I eventually went back. And I nearly failed my culinary school exam. So there's this notion in there of expectations, right? Whether it's from our families, from our societies, you know, just the stereotypes that we often feel, whether as women or just as a person from a different culture that we're subjected to. Now, by any measure, you're the epitome of success in your field. So I guess I want to start out, not to your face. So I just want to start out tonight by asking you, how has the road been getting to this point?
Mostly failures. You know, you just see the success. No one remembers your failures except for you. I remember them all the time.
Of course.
It was like not a straight path. I didn't initially want to go into food media.
Right.
My goal was to be a fancy Michelin star chef like Gordon Ramsay.
Wow.
Yeah. I was really good with like knives and curse words.
I think you're cooler, but okay.
So I ended up doing food media because our restaurant failed.
I see.
Spectacularly. It was terrible. Okay. So after that, I was really, I kind of just like gave up because the restaurant failure wasn't my first restaurant, like wasn't my first failure in the restaurant industry.
Okay.
Like I really wanted to be an executive chef at like a Michelin star restaurant. Mm. And when I couldn't get that position, that's when I pushed towards just opening my own.
Mm-hmm.
I really had all these dreams to like stage in Europe and that never worked out. So the restaurant closing was my final, like the final thing that made me not want to be in that industry anymore. Mm-hmm. I was like, maybe I need to take a break from this, but I still wanted to be in food because I loved it and also because I really can't do anything else. And it worked out. After the restaurant closed, I applied everywhere.
Oh, okay.
It was like a full blitz.
Uh-huh.
Like hundreds and hundreds of applications and pitches, and it took a few months before I got my first pitch accepted, and then it was from Serious Eats, and then I just kind of followed that path.
Right. You're pitching freelance articles.
Freelance articles and just applying to whatever random jobs I could find, private chef, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of worked out. Like once I kind of let go of this like really rigid idea of what I thought I wanted to be, what I wanted my life to look like, it actually started to be much better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because you said you let go of what these expectations that you had were. You talk about your family in the cookbook as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like you know, I come from, I'm Palestinian, so for my family, the food world was always seen as, the woman's domain at home, but outside of the home, going into food, like you're saying, you didn't want to go into, you know, the food media world, it was kind of seen as somewhat lowbrow. Like my mother's response when I said I want to write a cookbook was, who goes to Wharton to write cookbooks? She has since rescinded that comment, but still, that was, you know, it just shows you what the thought was. What was your family's view when you said, I want to go into food?
Well, I really liked cooking as a kid,
uh-huh.
and they were very supportive of that because they just thought I would be a really good wife.
Okay.
So when I said I wanted to go into this professionally, they were totally blindsided, even though all the clues were there.
Of course, in hindsight, 2020.
But yeah, I would like spend my childhood playing pretend restaurant, and I would like draw my dream restaurant and menus, and my favorite thing to do was have everyone sit down and like I would pretend it was a restaurant and I'd serve everybody.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And then they were so surprised and
you're like, why?
Quite mad.
Yeah.
So going to culinary school was the first big signal to them that I was gonna commit to this, and they were very unhappy. I didn't really have their support. And I think the hardest thing was they had all, like, the aunties and uncles, they would all constantly call me and tell me how I was disappointing the family bringing shame on the family.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So it's, like, it was really hard. These are people that I, like, really loved and respected. So I had to fully break off from my family for several years before I could, so I could continue. So I had to be really focused and a little obsessive about my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only recently started talking to everyone again, especially after having a daughter.
Yeah.
Before having her, I like didn't want to talk to anyone because I was like, oh, you guys. I was angry. But now that I've had her, like I get it. They were scared. For them, it's like a very scary thing for me to go into this industry because they left a lot of scary things to come here and raise me here so that I could have a secure job.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me to get into this career that's not secure. And when I started, really the only option was to work in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Which for a woman back then, it was not a good workplace.
No. Mm-hmm.
So I totally understand their fears. Like my perspective towards them has changed so much just from having a kid.
That's amazing. And are they super proud of you now? Have they changed, like my mom changed her opinion?
Yeah, but it was only because I was on TV.
Oh.
It was because of the Big Brunch. The only thing they don't care about anything.
No books, no articles, none of it. Just the TV show. Well, speaking of that, then when did you decide that you want to do a book, right? Because you've done a lot. You have a TV show. You write. You know, there's so many things that we can point to that you've done. But at what point did you think, this is it, I need to write a cookbook? Or did it even happen that way?
I didn't really know that I wanted to write a cookbook. I was really encouraged by my friend, Rick Martinez.
Okay.
You may have heard of him. And he's the one that really pushed me to go for it, and he connected me with his agent. Okay. And it was really support from him and other people, like Priya, and that's what made me want to do this.
Okay. And I guess I want you to tell us a bit more about what goes into writing a cookbook like this, because I've written two books, and combined, they don't weigh as much as this one. But I do know that a lot of love and sweat and tears goes into producing these things. So if someone's going to use it, they should probably know what that process is like, you know?
Well, I guess for me, I really wanted to make the book that I wish I had when I started cooking. Mm. When I only had a couple cookbooks growing up, and we didn't have Food Network or internet. I'm really old, guys.
You don't look it. It's okay.
So it was really hard for me to understand those books because it almost feels like it's written in a different language.
Okay.
And English wasn't my first language.
Oh,
so combining that with the fact that a lot of cookbooks use words that feel scary, like saute and sweat and cut butter into flour, they're not familiar terms. So I really wanted to make something really accessible for someone who doesn't know those words, because I want it to feel like anyone can cook and it doesn't matter. Those words don't matter.
Right.
You just need to get the message across. And then also I was really inspired by how much I hated culinary school.
Oh, I don't. Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay, nobody go to school. That's the one message.
That was actually one of my questions, but okay, we'll delve deeper into it in a bit.
You don't learn how to cook in culinary school at all. I think there was a time where the program was better, but because going to culinary school has become pretty cool, the classes are pretty overcrowded, and learning to cook is so much just about touching and feeling and practicing, and because the classes were so crowded, there wasn't really any opportunity to do much cooking. So I had this seafood class, 3 weeks long.
Okay.
In 3 weeks.
You never touched a fish?
I opened one clam.
Okay.
And broke down one piece of fish.
That's it.
And that was 3 weeks.
Wow.
So
meanwhile, you're bleeding, you know, money to go there.
Yeah, I broke down one chicken and I had to share it with someone, so I broke down half the chicken, and passed it over. So I don't think that it's a great place to learn, but having it on my resume did make it easier to get those, like, get into those fancy French restaurants that I wanted to work at. But now that I've been in the industry, I realize that chefs don't do background checks. Just lie.
I went to the CIA. I sat in a Michelin restaurant.
An applause for lying.
But you say that your book, you call it what? A one-stop culinary school without years of inescapable debt. So I guess if someone does want to go to school, is it necessary to make it in the food world today? I mean, whether it's the food writing world or restaurants, or is it just if you want to make it in fancy, like Michelin starred places?
I mean, if you can afford it, it's a cool opportunity, go for it. But I don't think you should get loans, because I was like buried in loans until like very recently, and I had to get like famous to pay off my loans. So I think it's something that you need to, like, I don't know, growing up I was taught that like you have to go to college.
Yeah.
But now I do think it's something you have to think about a bit more critically, because those loans really do just.
Yeah. And I think we see that in a lot of schools as well.
Yeah.
I always say that about business school. If someone pays for it, go. Otherwise, skip it.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to the cookbook. I guess I wanted to know, there's about 200 recipes in there. How did you go about figuring out which recipes you want to put in, or which ones, more importantly, to keep out? Because I feel you end up having way more than you can include.
Well, I had a lot of spreadsheets.
Excel.
Yeah. I had the recipes broken down by like cuisine and by category, like vegetable, meat, seafood, and by technique.
Okay.
So the goal with each chapter, every recipe's main purpose is to teach you a technique.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can get recipes anywhere.
True.
So the recipes really are there to be lessons more than anything else, and I want you to take that and then, you know, figure out your own recipes. But I also wanted to make sure if you are just going in there and looking for a weeknight meal, that there's something that will work for any like dietary restriction. Mm. And I really also wanted to make sure that I represented various cuisines, because it's like a lot of times when you think about these core techniques like braising or sauteing, you just think about the European dishes.
Right.
But all of these techniques are very universal and global, and I wanted to make sure that you can see that when you open up the book.
Which is beautiful. Was there a part of, you know, it's obviously a very involved process, but were there parts of it that you enjoyed more or parts that you hated?
Of the writing?
Of like getting a cookbook out in the world.
Oh, all of the writing I hate.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
You like the cooking?
I didn't even like that much. I like the photo shoot.
Oh, you do? That's the part. I hated that part.
I love the photo shoot.
But it's so, and you have so many pictures in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's process, final shot. You love that?
We shot it all in our apartment over 3 weeks.
That's it?
And it was me, my husband. Mm. I got the best partner ever because since he's a chef.
He does that, yeah.
Yeah, we do it all together. And then for culinary assistants, it was a producer from History Channel. So it was all folks I'd worked with for a really long time. Mm. So it was just like super fun. Mm-hmm. We were doing 12 to 14 recipes a day. So it was like really fast paced, really long days. And I just love working like that. Like I love at the end of each week, we couldn't even look at each other. We were so tired. Yeah. We would have like a bottle of wine and then everyone would go home and cry. And that's like for me, how I like to work.
Oh my gosh, that sounds very intense. I hated the photo shoots. Because of that, it was just too long.
Call me for your next one.
I will. I think I'm done writing cookbooks, but yeah, maybe I changed my mind. So we mentioned that Sola just had a baby, and you're lucky. You're lucky that she's still small and she's not a harsh critic of your food, because I put food in front of my kids and they're like, "Ugh, what is that?" So she probably still enjoys what you're feeding her.
Well, it's one thing. There's one thing.
The best thing, I guess, but how has being pregnant and now having had her changed your relationship with food? And that could be whether it's cooking or eating or...
A lot. I guess when I was pregnant, and even now because I'm nursing...
So sorry.
Hi.
It's the worst moment of my life.
Is she running away? Yes, a round of applause. when I was pregnant and nursing, I was really very focused on making sure that I eat enough nutrients, because I'm feeding her through me.
Right.
And it made me realize that my relationship with food's not great.
Oh, why?
I really only eat when other people are around. Oh. So I never like thought about food as something to nourish me. Mm. And whenever I'm alone, I don't eat well. And I realized that I was not taking care of myself. So now I think about the food that I like feed myself a lot more, and it's not just about feeding other people. Mm-hmm. So I think that my relationship with food has improved a lot, and I really wish that I had come to this epiphany before writing the book, because I have way more better recipes coming for the next book, guys.
Oh.
And I also am thinking more about efficiency, obviously, because I'm always holding a baby.
Of course.
Yeah.
So what do you have for breakfast now?
Oatmeal almost every day.
I read that somewhere.
You already saw. A savory oatmeal, though.
I had never heard of that until I read your interview, believe it or not.
It's so good.
It is. I tried it. My husband's like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "I read Sola has this for breakfast. I'm going to try it." It was good.
And
soy sauce.
With a little bone broth?
Uh-huh.
Cook the oats. You got to get Anson Mill oats.
Yes, I read about that.
Okay,
too.
So these oats, I could talk about those forever.
It's okay. Tell us a bit.
So they're not rolled oats, and they're not steel cut oats. They're stone ground oats. So a different texture. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of chew, just like a steel cut, but it cooks as quickly as a rolled oat.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody go get it. But not all at once, because I don't want it to sell out.
It'll sell out, and then you won't have any more.
Yeah, and then you cook it in bone broth and top it with an egg, a little soy, and a little maple. And
it's good. It is. I tried it. I can vouch for it. Mm-hmm. Well, while we're on the subject of what you eat, I'm going to ask you about what you have for dinner. But before that, you also, I've been reading a lot of your interviews. You stalker much, but no, I'm kidding. I was prepping for this. You mentioned somewhere that your mother, even after a long day's work, would come home and she would set the dinner table with mm-hmm. a very traditional Bangladeshi style, at least most nights, which involved a lot of different components. I try to do that. Doesn't always work, but it's exhausting, and I see how much goes into preparing a meal and actually having dinner time as a family. I know your daughter is still young, but do you see yourself like moving in that direction? Do you have a newfound appreciation, I guess, for that ritual that you had growing up?
Well, it's a problem because my husband also grew up eating with like a big spread.
Yeah.
Oftentimes he was, because he grew up in Qatar, so they would do all the dips and the rice and grilled meat, all of that. So we don't feel like it's a proper dinner unless there's like five plates on the table. Uh-huh. So it's just, it's a lot. But if we're ever busy and we have to eat like a one plate meal, we just feel like we didn't eat dinner.
Oh, wow.
It's like not the best habit.
So you have to have multiple things.
Yeah, we need to it needs to be like Thanksgiving every night.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of prep.
Yeah, but like I'm doing it with him. Mm-hmm. So we can actually, between the two of us, we can get a lot done in like an hour. So I think being able to share this, chore. It's, yeah. It doesn't feel like a chore.
It doesn't feel like a chore if you enjoy it.
But being able to share it with someone, and we do all the cooking and cleaning and shopping together, so it's really not that bad for us.
So you cook every night?
Most nights. We're not huge leftovers fans.
Uh-huh. It's okay. I don't blame you. I find chicken leftover has a taste that I cannot stomach, but maybe we can get into the science of it if you know, but...
No, you're totally right.
Am I?
We've gotten really good at making exactly enough for two people, uh-huh. So it's going to get tough to figure out how to squeeze a third person in there.
A tiny third person. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you do put on the dinner table? Like, tell us an average dinner.
Well, like, last night we did some dips. A soft tofu with tahini dip.
Okay.
A little edamame dip.
Oh, wow.
There was like a roast chicken mm-hmm. that had leftover pesto. Okay, there was some leftovers. But we repurposed it. You smear the pesto all over and then roast the chicken. It's
and
really
it feels
good.
Like it's new again.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. With potatoes and chickpeas roasted underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. A little salad.
It's nice. It's a lot of stuff.
It's chill.
So you mentioned you're working on a second book. Or uh-huh. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, or is it still...
I kind of think I know what I want to do, but I don't think I'm allowed to tell you.
Oh, you're not allowed to.
Sorry, guys. It's going to be like 3 years.
Oh, wow. So it's going to be a while. Okay, well, I mean, it'll probably take 3 years to get through this one if you're going to cook every single recipe, so... I did want to ask you, we touched on it a bit at the beginning, but you mentioned failures, right? And you talk about this in the book. You say, it's, I guess I want to call it the gift of failing almost, because that's where learning comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about how you messed up the cake, but then you also talked about now when you failed at the restaurant. What are some instances where things haven't worked out the way you've wanted, but they've kind of been pivotal in getting you to where you are right now?
I mean,
sorry,
I think...
Sorry to put you on the spot.
I mean, that's a big question. I feel like most of my life, honestly. Like, I was married before.
Oh.
And that was a great, horrible relationship, because now I have a fantastic relationship. Because I learned a lot from my starter marriage. and I think dropping out of school, too.
Right.
I didn't understand what I was doing with my life. So, like, dropping out of school and living a really chaotic 1 year helped me get back on track and get focused. Because mm-hmm. before that, I was not. Now I'm always focused all the time.
You are?
And I believe it's because of that.
Interesting.
That lost year.
Yeah.
Which, like, everyone in my family, they were so worried about me. They thought that I was never going to come back from that. They were even like, they even told me multiple times. Multiple people told me my life was over.
Really? I mean, I guess I see how families like ours might think that.
But I think it was the best thing that happened, because that's why I'm so, like, I think I'm pretty organized mm-hmm. and focused and I believe it's because of that.
Yeah.
I saw what it could be on the other side. You know, if I didn't have focus and a point, like a goal in my life, what would happen, you know?
So now you've kind of seen the alternative and it's...
My whole life is just running away from that.
No, but I mean, I'm glad you talk about it because a lot of times people will see you sitting up on stage and they'll think like, wow, look at how this person has made it. And it can be intimidating or it can feel like, you know, your path has been this upward trajectory, but nobody sees the dips that are happening along the way. And I think those are the dips probably that, like you were saying, really propel you.
Well, I mean, I still feel like a loser.
Join the club.
I have this theory that I think everyone feels for their whole life the way they felt when they were 8. Right? So if you felt like you were a loser when you're 8, you're going to feel like a loser no matter what you do.
And still
sorry, guys.
No, no, but it's true. I think we're like stuck in that mind frame when we were little kids and, you know, you accomplish a lot, but still the insecurities have a way of creeping up every once in a while.
On the flip side, if you were the popular kid when you're an 8, you probably like peaked.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So encourage our kids not to be so popular, I guess. Uh-huh. I know we have a lot of questions from the audience, actually. So I want to get to some of them.
Cool.
And some are fun, like this one. What are the 3 kitchen tools that you cannot do without? This is by someone who says, with so much love, Alfie.
Thanks, Alfie. I guess number one is a solid, good knife, sharp knife. Mm-hmm. I believe any knife is a good knife if it's sharp.
I agree. I chopped off my finger with a blunt one three weeks ago at this point.
The blunt ones are the ones to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. My mom is so scared of big knives.
Me too.
But
what's up with our moms?
I know. Even though every time she sees me chop, she's panicking. And I'm like, you know that I do this for a living. A sharp knife. I don't think you need to stress too much about it being like fancy or Japanese or what kind of bevel or even like, I don't like the term chef's knife because everyone thinks it's like the 9-inch German Wusthof, but in professional kitchens, chefs use whatever knife.
As long as it's sharp.
And like that works for what they're working on. So like I know some guys who do all of their prep with like a slicer.
Okay.
Or all of the prep with the cleaver. So just like whatever you're comfortable in your hand, a sharp knife. And then tweezer tongs.
Oh. What do you use those for?
So many
for?
Snaps. Everything. Everything. It's got the precision of tweezers, but the heft of tongs.
If there's any tweezer tong manufacturer, there you go.
I think my goal would be like to make my own tweezer tongs. Yeah. I like the restaurant supply silicone spatula.
Okay.
Which people online make fun of me for all the time.
Why?
Because it's not pretty, but it will last you way longer than the cute like pink one that you found online.
Okay. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I go through those a lot. I should
restaurant supply.
I will do one of those. Uh-huh. You mentioned a sharp knife. How do you sharpen your knives? I know I should be using the stone, but I can't do that on a regular basis.
We do stone on the weekends. It's kind of how we hang out because...
You guys are cool.
I don't know if it's... It's really funny that all of our really, really pathetic habits are being framed as cool. Like, what do you do on a Saturday? We sharpen our knives.
Oh, that could...
And then once a year we send it to Corin. It's good to send it in for professional sharpening. Make sure go to someone who's going to hand sharpen it because when they do it on the wheels, they take off a lot of the blades. So we take it to Corin, they hand sharpen it, and it just realigns the blades. So then at home you kind of just have to maintain that.
Okay, good to know.
But if it's really dull, send it to somebody.
Yeah, I after I ended up in the ER, I sent my knife to get sharpened. Oh, it was very embarrassing because some guy, the doctor comes in and he goes, aren't you Rim Cassis the food writer? I'm like, yes, and I chopped my finger off while cooking, so sharpen your knives. Okay, so this person says, are the holidays a time for classic or innovative bakes? I mean, which holiday? Also, I don't know. I guess this holiday season?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an excuse to bake as much as you want.
And eat as much as you want?
So just make all of it, yeah. You know?
What do you bake around this time of year?
Whatever I want.
Whatever you feel.
Yeah, a lot of cookies.
Oh.
And I've been really craving a gingerbread loaf.
Oh, okay.
But I haven't found a recipe that I like yet, so I think I'm going to make one for next year. Next. It's going to take a while. Sorry, guys.
How many times do you test your recipes?
It depends on the recipe. For baking, oftentimes, like, a lot. Like, up to, like, a dozen times, because I like to try it with different brands.
Okay.
Because my goal is to make a recipe that'll work with whatever brand of flour you buy, but it doesn't always happen. So I'll check and... And then when folks will ask, they'll undoubtedly someone will be like, can I use almond flour? And I'll be like, no.
So we can trust your recipes. They work. Well, maybe this is actually the answer to this question, because this person wants to know, what did you want to do with this book to set it apart, either from your own previous work? Well, it's your first cookbook, but or from other people's cookbooks. Like, what sets it apart? I mean, I think it's a beast of its own, but you tell me.
Well, the most important part for me was accessibility.
Okay.
So it's not like the sexiest thing. I'm a really bad reader. Uh-huh. So I can't read most cookbooks because the numbers and letters,
too small,
and I just like my brain can't compute. So I actually have to rewrite it in my own handwriting.
Okay.
And then I put all these lines and dividers. So I tried to kind of design it in a way that makes sense in my brain and hopefully it makes sense for other people. Mm-hmm. And also the font is gigantic.
I noticed, I guess as we get older, it's useful.
You need it.
You need
it. I think the cookbook should be on the counter while
That's
you're
true.
Cooking. So, like, That's I true. Want it to be something you actually cook out of. So it lays flat.
Yes.
We got the big font. You can actually cook out of it.
Actually, my mother-in-law's only comment on my first cookbook was that she couldn't read the font. It was too small.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I love her, but it's okay. What are your dog's favorite bedtime snacks? I didn't know dogs had bedtime snacks.
We don't. We're very strict with treats, so they don't actually get that many treats. We want them to stay trim, fit. So they got to work for their treats.
I need to stop my bedtime snacks then.
I'm not strict with my own, no. It's easier for the dogs.
So let's see. Oh, who is your food celeb crush? You said you wanted to be cooler than Gordon Ramsay, or you wanted to be like Gordon Ramsay?
I wanted to be like him.
Like him.
But not be with him.
No.
crush? You know who I really like? I like Brooke from Top Chef.
Yeah.
Oh.
Huh?
Nice.
She seems fun.
So another thing about what you love, where does your love of cooking come from? Because you said you loved it since you were a kid.
Well, my mom's a really good cook, so I would spend a lot of time with her. But I think it was not so much about the food, but the fact that it was the one place where I could get along with my family.
Okay.
Because we never really got along, because my family's quite conservative, and I've never been. And the one time where we weren't fighting... was when we were either cooking or eating, and that's kind of what's magical about food, you know, because you can really get along with anybody over food, and that's the real reason.
And your family, they came from Bangladesh to the U.S. Were you born here, or no?
I was born here.
You were, okay.
It was like a strictly Bangladesh and Arabic household, so I didn't speak English until I was too old.
Okay.
And then I went to a Spanish-speaking school in L.A.
You can.
So I was very confused for a really long time.
Oh my God! Yeah, that's what happens to our kids, I guess. When oh my God! As if they were hearing us. How does being Bangladeshi influence the way that you cook?
Well, I think that's a big reason why I like to have a lot of little things. Because that's what's fun about having a Bangladeshi meal.
Mm-hmm.
You've got your rice, and then you have all these little things, and then you can kind of, throughout your meal, make like your own little bite.
Right.
Mix and match. So I really like to eat that way. Mm-hmm. And then I really like Bangladeshi food has a lot of mustard and bitter. Mm-hmm. I feel like you don't see that use of bitter in a lot of other cuisines. And okay. I've used it a lot in the book. Like there's a charred lemon risotto mm-hmm. where you like blacken the lemons. And that bitterness transforms into savory when you balance right. it with the butter and the cheese. So I really like playing with that flavor.
So when you say mustard, you mean like mustard green type of bitter?
Or mustard oil.
Oil, okay. Mm-hmm. So in this country, you still has a label on it for external use only, right?
Mustard. Yeah.
It's bizarre. I mean, I use it, but...
Nick Sharma has an article about it.
I read it, yes.
And I read it and I forgot.
I think he said there's like one brand that's selling it here that is...
That brand's not good.
It's not good? Okay, good to know. Good to know.
Get the one that says for external use
that's
only.
That's what I normally get, so... while we're on the subject, I mean, there's a lot of cuisines, now that you think about it, actually, that do this mm-hmm. small place, you know, mm-hmm. Arabic cuisine with meze, Bangladesh yeah. with that, Korean with banchan.
Most of them.
I know.
Spanish
right?
tapas.
Exactly.
Why are we always eating like English people?
I know. Meat and potatoes.
They have the worst food. I'm sorry if you're English.
Okay, so this is about developing recipes. Do you take calculated risks when developing recipes, or is it more spontaneous? How do you develop recipes, I mean, when you're doing it?
Well, I usually, I make what I want to make, mm-hmm. which tends to be way too hard. And then I pull it back.
Okay.
Because, like, the stuff I want to make... It's going to have, since I live in New York, I have like access to a lot more ingredients than the average person in this mm-hmm. country. So it might have like a lot of ingredients and a lot of equipment mm-hmm. and take too long.
Right.
So I'll start there, though, mm-hmm. you know, for inspiration. Then I pull back and then still people say everything's too hard. One of the complaints was that everything was too hard in this. And I was like, this is supposed to be easy.
Wait, they said the recipes in this book are too hard.
Uh-huh.
Disagree.
I disagree.
But I think the kitchen can be intimidating for people who, I mean, it's when I come to cook, I'm like, oh, this is easy. You just have to do A, B, C, D. And my brother's like, are you nuts? Like, this is complicated. You know, whatever, chopping chicken to someone who's yeah. never cooked feels like an uphill climb. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned ingredients because you live in New York. For people who don't live in, do you buy stuff online, A? And if yes, do you recommend places for like spices, for... hard to source ingredients, like single origin spices or...
Well, my favorite thing is to go to SOS Chefs, okay. which I don't believe they deliver. Mm. But like, it's fun because it she gets everything, I think, direct from Iran or throughout the Middle East. So it's okay. like super fresh and it's just a really fun experience because she'll take you in the back and she'll be like, come on, come eat some dates. And it's like, it feels very luxurious, right. luxurious spice shopping experience. But other than that, I think Burl Oven Barrel has really, really solid stuff.
Okay.
Don't you have something with Burl Oven Barrel?
Not me. No, the other room.
Sorry.
It's okay, because we just talked about that. No.
But everything's like very high quality yeah. and ethically sourced, and they work directly with farmers. But you can find most things online, mm-hmm. but I still like, I feel like for the average recipe, I want you to be able to cook with whatever you can find. That's so true. You can just yeah. like walk into a grocery store and, you know, grab a bag of carrots.
Yeah. And cook. And nowadays you find a lot of stuff even in mainstream supermarkets. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. There's tahini everywhere.
I know. I know. Yeah. Even za'atar is everywhere. I mean,
yeah.
I would argue it's not za'atar, but still it's.
It's not always good. That you can find it.
You can find it. Okay. What fictional world would you want to live in and why? Oh, these are like the questions my kids ask me.
What fictional world? Like from CV?
What fictional world would you want to live in and why? Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Wow.
I'm telling you, I mean, I...
I'm not, like, stoned right now. I've been watching a lot of Dexter.
That's kind of... You don't want to live in that world, though, do you?
It's fine if you're Dexter.
I've been watching The Gilded Age, but I guess that's not fictional. That does seem like a fun era to live in.
Yeah.
Although uh-huh. when I said that to my husband, he said, no, only if you're the people in that show. Okay, this is fun. What are your top three snacks?
Popcorn.
Oh, just plain or flavored? Or?
Oh, I can talk about popcorn.
Let's talk about popcorn.
Okay, so remember the oats?
Yes.
I get popcorn from the same people, Anson Mills. Once you have this popcorn, you're going to realize you've never had popcorn before in your life.
Really?
It's so flavorful. You got to keep it in your fridge. All of their stuff is so fresh that you really have to keep it frozen.
Okay.
And then how to pop it?
Yes.
Use a Whirly Pop. Yes. Yes. It's the best for
What's
popping.
What's a Whirly Pop?
So it's this really thin aluminum pot. Because it's thin, it transfers the heat very quickly.
Uh-huh.
And it has a vented lid. So the steam escapes, and then it has a little hand crank so you can keep the kernels moving.
Oh, my God.
So you end up with, like, perfectly crispy, evenly popped popcorn. And then, so I like to pop it in a lot of clarified butter so you don't have to add butter later. So it's, like, a third of a cup of popcorn for a quarter cup of clarified butter.
Wow. Nice. I'm going to come watch movies at your house from now.
Yeah. And then you need to really finely grind your seasoning in a spice grinder, even the salt, then it sticks really well. And my favorite seasoning is my burlap and barrel Hidden Valley Ranch seasoning. Mix that with some nutritional yeast and salt, blitz it up. So you're going to pop your popcorn. Okay, once it's popped, you pour it into, you need two big bowls.
Okay.
You pour it into one big bowl, sprinkle over the seasoning, and then you're going to like sift it back and forth, back and forth. Just like when they make chai in Bangladesh to get it really frothy. You sift it back and forth. This evenly distributes the seasoning, just like a tumbler in a professional, like industrial like thing. And it dissipates the heat so it stays really crunchy. It's perfect.
I am never going to have popcorn like the one I had before again. I'm going to do yours.
Yeah, you got to do it. It's really good.
What's the name of that pot again?
A Whirly Pop.
A Whirly Pop.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You learn something new every day.
I have two more snacks to pick.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We forgot. Two more.
Okay, I like these wasabi soy almonds from Blue Diamond.
Okay.
And just like random shrimp cocktail from the grocery store.
That's a good one.
Uh-huh. It's at every grocery store.
Any grocery store. So shrimp, wasabi, peas, and
sometimes I
together?
Buy it while I'm shopping. And then you just give them the like top to charge you at the end.
That's a very luxurious shopping snack.
Yeah, just eat some shrimp cocktail.
So what was your favorite mystery menu New York Times cooking challenge?
Oh, I think my favorite was durian. It's not something I really worked with before.
Okay.
My mom would get, so my dad loves jackfruit.
Yeah, I love it too. I've never had durian.
So my dad would always go to the store and buy what he thought was jackfruit. And it turned out to be durian. And my mom would get really mad. So that was my only like durian experience. And then we would just like crankily eat this thing that no one really wanted. But I had never cooked with it before.
Okay.
So cooking it with it was a really cool experience because the flavor really transforms depending on what you pair it with and how you cook it. And that was just really fun because it was the first one where I was working with something I legitimately had never worked with before.
What does it taste like for those who have never had it?
So if you eat it like, if you eat it just as the fruit, it's very custardy, and it kind of tastes like all the tropical fruits combined, like papaya, banana, mango, but it smells terrible. So you have to get past the smell. It's kind of like eating a poisse. That poisse is that like stinky French cheese that smells so bad that there's laws against having it in public places. But when you get over the smell, it's like the most delicious cheese. So similar vibe, but what's really cool is when you pair it with different things, like when we added it with fish sauce, it got like super savory. When we added acid to it, it got really nutty. So it's a fun thing to experiment with. The flavor just kept changing when we were putting in different dishes.
So interesting. Are there any recipes in this book that have it?
No, because you can't buy it at a grocery store. That was my rule.
You have to buy it at just a regular grocery store.
To be in the book, yeah.
Okay. Well, what do you listen to while you are cooking or developing recipes?
I just listen to, like, books. Like, Yuval Harari.
Oh my God, I love that book, Sapiens.
Yeah. Or like podcasts. Yeah, I don't, music is too distracting. I feel like when I listen to music, I get like way too emotional.
Yeah.
I'll just like listen to Aerosmith and cry.
So. All right.
Have you heard the new, that band, Blink 182 song?
Which one?
They have a new song and it's really sad and you just listen, I just listen to it and cry. Oh.
No, I have to listen to what my kids put on Alexa, which these days is better when I'm dancing.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. But they're always dancing, so that's what I have to listen to. I don't have much of a choice. Can you recommend an affordable... Oh, we were talking about knives before. Can you recommend an affordable and quality knife set for a broke student who loves to cook? Thank you. Aw.
I think the Wusthof knives are pretty solid.
Okay.
And I also like Meissen.
Okay.
But I recommend avoiding sets. I think they're kind of a scam.
Yeah.
Like, I think get your chef's knife from them.
Okay.
And then for, you just need a little paring knife, which can be anything. Okay. And then a serrated knife, which it's better to get cheaper because they can't be sharpened.
Yeah. I love the Victorinox ones. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I should admit this or not. I didn't actually have a chef's knife or a big knife till I think after my first cookbook came out.
And you made it.
I made it.
You made it work.
Yeah, I used those, you know, serrated knives that my grandmother used to chop onions like this with, and it was fine.
One of the knives I use the most is like a teeny tiny serrated Victorinox.
I love it.
You just pull it out when you need to cut a lemon or something real quick.
And then I use scissors for meat. I know that's maybe...
No,
I, not be doing
I think
that,
that's fine.
It worked.
Yeah.
So anyway, you can also buy a pair of scissors and a serrated knife. If you can only serve one dish to your guests for the rest of your life, what would it be? Love, Momo.
Oh, roast chicken.
Oh, why?
Because it's always exciting.
Okay.
Like, there's something always really comforting and welcoming and just, like, I feel like it's the most hospitable dish.
It feels homey, right? Uh-huh. You see a whole chicken.
Show up with a whole chicken and you can even put all your veggies in there. I mean, if it's us, there's going to be a whole bunch of extra things on the side. But if I have to pick one thing, it's going to be whole roast chicken.
So I love that idea. I always say I'm going to make roast chicken, and I do. And then I have to carve it. Oh, my God. Do you carve it at the table when you have guests?
No. I like to, you know, they look at the chicken, and then you cut it in the chicken.
Back.
In the kitchen. Yeah.
That's like Thanksgiving and the turkey. You spend, I know, show it to the kids, and then it's 20 minutes of carving the thing until you have it ready.
Yeah, but no. Do that in private.
Okay, so this one we've already discussed. Do you have plans for a book after this one? Yes, but it's top secret right now. Mm-hmm. If you could only have sauces the rest of your life, what would they be? Sauces?
No, three sauces.
Three sauces?
Yeah.
For the rest of my life?
No, not the rest of your life. Just like in general.
My top three sauces.
Yeah.
I like Valentina's hot sauce, homemade ranch. and Hellman's mayo.
What do you have the mayo with? Well, I guess with a lot of stuff.
You know, sandwiches.
Yeah.
The normal things.
So here's another dog fan. Tell me everything about your dogs. wait, there's more. Or, if just one thing, what is their favorite human food then?
Oh, okay, so this is weird, but so Vito is a Shiba Inu,
okay,
which is a Japanese breed. Mm-hmm. But he has never been to Japan, okay, just to be clear. But anytime we eat Japanese food, he loses his mind.
Why? Really?
He doesn't care about food normally, but like every time we make dashi, he goes crazy. He tries to jump on the kitchen counter. If we have sushi or soba, I don't know what it is.
Some stuff has to be genetic.
It's so weird.
It is.
And then Clementine is an English bulldog. Mm-hmm. So true to her nature, she'll eat anything.
Okay, so we have a couple of minutes left. There's a lot more questions. I'm sorry we're not going to get through all of them, but so here's, what role does creativity play in your work and how do you channel it?
Oh, that's a big question.
Big question. Okay, let's find something a little.
That's like the whole talk.
I know, right? Very philosophical. Did COVID change the way you approach this book? When you started, you started after COVID? I'm
guessing. Yes, I think it did. Okay. COVID actually changed the way I think about food a lot, because I used to be very, very like, you have to use this ingredient, you have mm-hmm. to follow this recipe. So during COVID is kind of when I started talking to people about substitutions and how to make what they have work, because you couldn't go out and just buy things, and a lot of things you couldn't even find.
Yeah.
And that's what inspired the Off Script with Sola series, where it was more like focused on, here's a template. And you make it work with your own stuff. So a lot of the recipes in here are like that.
Okay.
And there's a little get loose section to help you, you know, give you a little inspiration on how to play around with what you have. But mm-hmm. in terms of the savory side, you really can get crazy.
Okay.
That's
useful. It's very helpful.
That's because COVID made me crazy.
Yeah. All of us. here's a quick and easy one. What is your favorite Bengali sweet, mishti?
Oh, the... Besta burfi. Sorry, my Bengali is really bad.
We wouldn't know, so don't tell us.
Okay, it's a little pistachio kind of, it's like kind of like the sesame halva, but pistachio.
Oh, where can you buy that?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. Most of the places where you buy it, they make it with like almonds and then add food coloring and flavor, so it's not quite good. So the best thing is just to make it yourself.
Okay.
Get Sicilian pistachios from Calustians.
Okay.
And like really commit. Uh-huh. And it's so good.
What's it called again?
Besta burfi.
Besta burfi, okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'll make it, we'll tag
my
you.
My parents are coming this week and my Bengali will get better.
Would you and Ham open another restaurant?
We talk about it all the time.
Oh, okay.
Let us know if you want to invest.
So I know you haven't had a long time to spend in Philly. You actually just got here right before the event. But mm-hmm. what are some of your favorite Philly desserts? What are Philly desserts? I know there's...
I've been here for half an hour.
Exactly. Okay.
And I'm leaving right now. I'm so sorry.
Okay. What dish brings you back to your childhood?
Oh,
the most dal.
Pani puri.
Oh. Nice.
I love it. There's some in our cabinet at all times.
Uh-huh.
I can just sit there and eat all of it. Mm. And it was whenever we went to Bangladesh, as soon as we landed, the first thing we did was get pani puri.
Okay.
So it's like, it's very special to me.
Yeah. My toxic trait is buying cookbooks and cooking one thing out of them. What is your toxic trait? Writing 200 of them?
So many things. Then I'm going to forever think I'm a loser.
Aww.
That's my toxic trait.
Well, you're not. And we love you.
No one's going to convince me.
Wait till your little one looks up at you and sees you.
Calls me a loser.
Not where I was going with that. But
I know that I only have a few years before she's mean to me.
Yeah. Probably a good decade, but then it
a
starts.
A decade, and then it gets all downhill.
Exactly. Yeah. Favorite fast food?
Taco Bell.
Yeah. Really?
Nachos Bel Grande.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
No meat.
Nice.
Not because I don't eat meat, just because I don't need the meat on that.
It's good.
There's enough going
it.
On. Yeah.
Okay. And this will be our last question, because we're almost out of time. Sola, so happy you're here. How do you stay inspired in the kitchen? And I guess you can leave us all on that inspiring note.
I guess our entire home is kitchen.
Yes, I've read that.
So our bedroom has kitchen. Our second bedroom is like additional kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And all we have are cookbooks. So I guess being around it all the time, there are times where I like am not into it, and then I'll just like find a book that I haven't looked at for a while, mm-hmm. or I'll just see a spice on my way to the bathroom, because I'm just like completely surrounded in it. And my husband also does it. It's very easy to constantly be creative and inspired.
Right.
So I guess just I'm fully immersed.
Yes.
All the time. And that works.
It's a wonderful answer. Guys, thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Casola.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.